This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there. I appreciate you tuning in. I'm Joel Hilliker. The coronavirus continues to spread. On Monday, the U.S. stock market dropped 1,000 points on fears of the economic impacts. There are more than 80,000 cases spreading around several countries. One nation being hit hard is Iran. The Islamic Republic has had a few deaths from the virus, and its neighboring nations are beginning to close their borders to try to prevent the disease from spreading. This is just the latest in a series of setbacks for Iran this year so far, with the death of its top general, Qasem Soleimani, economic effects of sanctions hitting hard, and other problems. There are people looking at this saying that it could mean the end of the Islamist regime. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about what this could mean given Iran's role in biblical prophecy. Germany is in the middle of a political crisis, a real leadership vacuum, and it's uncertain who Chancellor Angela Merkel's successor will be. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Josue Michels about one name that is being put forward as a candidate for Germany's next chancellor. It tells you quite a lot about the direction and the political climate within Germany right now. In our third segment, we will follow up on reports from earlier this year about wildfires in Australia. The situation took an unexpected turn as the nation has experienced record rainfall, which has brought problems of its own, severe storms and flooding. Now, some are saying that this, too, is a result of climate change, but there is plenty of evidence to the contrary. We'll hear a report from Ariana Eames about this. And I'll conclude the program by talking about how to never be offended. Before we get into anything else, I wanted to give a little listener feedback. We talked on last week's program with Jörg Mardian about extreme dieting, and he briefly mentioned the keto diet. He said that it was a diet that can be very helpful for people with certain conditions, but that can be difficult to sustain. Well, I got an email from another listener who is also a nutritionist, Geraldine Smothers, and I thought it would be worth reading her comments. She said, "I'm a certified nutritionist who's been on keto for almost 2 years. I've experienced huge benefits from it, but have also encountered numerous people who have not approached it properly and have therefore harmed themselves. Keto basics do not teach people about acid-alkaline balancing, so I still have to tell people to eat more veggies. The most nutritious foods on the planet are dark leafy greens. Many people don't realize that it's only high-fat, moderate protein at the beginning to help the body make the switch in energy sources. Once you start burning stored fat, you don't need to intake as much fat. You can up the protein and even adjust the carbs. Then after a few weeks, I recommend healthy carbs in a treat meal once a week. That gives people something to look forward to and helps them stay focused on eating right the rest of the week. This also allows for an alcoholic drink once a week if desired. Also, once people reach a healthy weight, they can slowly incorporate more carbs back in daily to fit their level of physical activity. Carbs are power foods. If people are sedentary, carbs don't fuel them. They just spike insulin and do harm." And then she says this, "Another issue I've encountered is that men tend to need more protein on keto, especially if they are already active, don't have weight to lose, and just need to address a pre-existing condition. This is just a few of the ways someone may do keto wrong for their body type. The problem with keto and most diets is that every body is different, and more people need to consult a nutritionist, dietitian, or naturopath to get insight into what they need specifically in their situation." So that report last week, it did cover quite a bit of ground in a short amount of time, and I thought that might be a little bit helpful to those who were listening to that may actually be interested in pursuing something like that. At any rate, we will move on to our main subject here in our first segment. We're going to start by hearing about Iran's terrible year in this report from Brent Noctegal.
Iran has eclipsed South Korea to record the highest tally of deaths from the rapidly spreading coronavirus outside of China. Three more people on Tuesday died in Iran, bringing the number to 15 deaths, with another 95 people infected. But that's just the official tally. The real figure of those infected is likely higher, far higher. On Monday, one Iranian lawmaker from the holy city of Qom, the epicenter of the Iranian outbreak, said that over 50 people had been killed from infection in that city alone, although the state-run media has since worked to silence that claim. Nevertheless, Iran's neighbors are not taking any risks. Turkey announced over the weekend that it suspected Iran had at least 750 cases of corona as of last Friday. Indeed, if the ratios of infections to deaths are similar to elsewhere, Turkey's figure might actually be on the low end of what Iran actually has. Turkey made its announcement as it decided to close its borders to transit from Iran in order to protect its own citizens. Other nations in the Middle East have since followed suit. Iraq, Armenia, Pakistan, Kuwait, and Afghanistan have all shuttered their borders to Iran or instituted stringent border checks. Internally, Iran has started to address the problem by closing schools, universities, and other gathering places in almost half of the country to attempt to slow the spread. But for many Iranians, the regime's deliberately delayed response to the deadly virus comes far too late. The first reported death from corona came last Wednesday. However, instead of introducing the rigorous quarantine and containment measures, Iran downplayed the significance of the outbreak and enacted a media blackout on information about the spread of the virus till after the much-anticipated parliamentary elections that took place on Friday. Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei expressed hope for a massive participation in the election to show solidarity with the direction of the regime. So, instead of doing what any normal country would do, cancelling the elections, alerting the public to the dangers associated with the outbreak, and the need to avoid large public gatherings, Iran muzzled the media and went ahead with its regime-endorsed vote. The result? The turnout for the vote was the lowest in the country's modern history. According to Interior Minister Abdulreza Rami Fazli, only 43% of Iran's 50 million eligible voters came out, 30% lower than a vote in 2017. In hindsight, the dismal election turnout might actually be a good thing for the regime as it now directs its attention to containing the outbreak. The low numbers mean that only 21 million Iranians were mixing together on election day rather than the 40 million that came out in 2017. It's still completely unclear how vast the coronavirus has already spread through Iran. With the election over, Iran has opened up its borders to teams of scientists and experts to help contain the virus, but it's hard to see a result where things don't get a lot worse for Iran before they start getting better. But that seems to be the year that Iran is having. The dismal showing at the ballot box in a rigged election and the forthcoming spread of coronavirus are only the latest massive setbacks for the Iranian regime. Here are a few more. On January 3rd, the United States assassinated Iran's terrorist mastermind Qasem Soleimani as well as his chief deputy in Iraq. In Iraq and Lebanon, massive protests continue to destabilize Iran's hold on those nations. And in Iraq specifically, Iranian-backed forces have killed almost 600 Iraqis on the streets to maintain its control there. In November, Iran had to turn its guns on its own population to put down massive internal protests over an increase in fuel prices. In that instance, Iranians were outraged that the government would increase taxes on the citizens, while Iran reported increases in spending to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. In those protests, 1,500 Iranians were killed by the regime in order to slow down a revolution. Then came Iran's failed attack on US bases in Iraq in late January. The missile strike was meant to be retribution for Soleimani's death, but instead failed to kill a single American. Then, in the process of that same missile strike, Iran accidentally shot down a commercial Ukrainian airliner as it took off from the country. In typical regime fashion, Iran failed to accept any blame for the disaster, which killed over 100 people. Later, Iran was forced to admit its culpability when video evidence of the downing became overwhelming. Add to those failings the continued strain on the Iranian economy brought on by American-led financial sanctions, and the Iranian regime probably could not have imagined a worse possible start for the year. For Khamenei, wrote Bobby Ghosh for Bloomberg on Tuesday, the only silver lining here is that Iranians too frightened to leave home for fear of the virus are unlikely, at least for now, to resume the anti-regime street protests, end quote. No doubt, public discontent is building in Iran against the regime. Plenty of brave Iranians are taking to social media to voice their outrage. And Iran's continued course supporting international terrorism is also further weakening and isolating the regime, cutting it off from world trade. By any metrics, the Iranian regime looks to be on a downward spiral towards total failure and perhaps revolution. Given all this, given Iran's present woes, it's astounding then that we at the Trumpet consistently forecast Iran's rise to dominate the Middle East. We hold true to that forecast because it's not based on the consistently shifting sands of Middle East geopolitics. It's not based on economic performance, and not even on the rise and fall of the United States' involvement in the Middle East. Rather, our forecasts to do with Iran and other nations are based on the bedrock of biblical prophecy. At times like this, when it looks like the Iranian regime is under serious threat, or may even falter, it's good to remember what the Bible says of Iran's future. Based on those prophecies, we actually forecast that Iran will grow strong enough to make a military push that will be felt in places far from the Middle East. The coronavirus, mass protests, economic sanctions, and international isolation will not bring down the Iranian regime. Indeed, the lengths to which Iran went to keep the knowledge of the spread of corona from its own people shows how committed the regime is to its grand scheme.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. You know, looking at events from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, there are definitely times that things take unexpected turns. I think of several forecasts that we've made over the years where we thought that it would be a pretty direct line between events that were taking place and what the Bible says was going to happen ultimately in that situation. But it's taken zigs and zags, and there are times when it's been years after making an initial forecast that something has come to pass. That certainly seems to be the case of what's happening here in Iran.
Yeah, it certainly does, considering this year. I mean, if you go back, let's say, to the President Obama's time in office, and we saw the Iranian regime not having to change absolutely anything about its outlook and how it, you know, still really taking over nations. It still had an offensive battle plan. It was in Syria fighting on the ground, and it was getting, because of the nuclear deal, it was getting a lot of money to further finance its belligerent acts, as we call them, but basically taking over other nations by proxy. It seemed at that point that Iran was really like full steam ahead, pushing towards the fulfillment of those biblical prophecies, being empowered in a dramatic way by the United States. And so it would have been easy to see a direct line from with that presidency and what was happening there to show that Iran would go on then with all this money and the ambition and no America to stop it, that it could take over fully the Middle East and make its prophesied push against Europe in a very, as you said, linear way from there. But really, I think what's very interesting with this is with the onset of President Donald Trump's presidency, the game has changed, and it has kind of, in a way, slowed down the way we thought the prophecy would be fulfilled. But I can already see in many ways how this recalibration of the Iranian regime is going to, because of, let's say, President Donald Trump or the coronavirus or the financial sanctions or this bad press it's getting from hitting the airliner, I can see that this, or even Soleimani's death, how this is kind of recalibrating Iran to position itself still in the future to fulfill those biblical prophecies, but perhaps going in a different route than we originally anticipated.
Well, that's an interesting point. The you could see a lot of people looking at what's happening in Iran right now who are no fans of the Islamic regime, who've wanted to see regime change there for a while. They're looking at this as, you know, this really could be a breaking point for the Iranian regime. And yet you look back at so many times where this is the direction that prophecy has said things were going to happen, and events took a different turn. You know, you can think of even something like Herbert W. Armstrong was talking about the fraught relationship between Britain and Europe decades ago, and then Britain actually joined the European Economic Community, and it wasn't until after 40 years plus that Britain actually got out of the European Union, as he said would happen back in 1956. You know, those types of things happen where it almost looks exactly the opposite of what Bible prophecy says, and yet eventually things come around to doing exactly what we would expect. And in this case, you know, we've been talking about Syria. We've been talking about this, say, break between Syria and Iran for some time as this civil war has been taking place in Syria. And yet Assad has held on to power longer than we expected. You look at Iran's influence there and in Lebanon and other places in the region where prophecy says there is going to be a break.
Yeah, I think it is really interesting in terms of, you know, this recalibration that Iran is going to have to do, because Bible prophecy does indicate that they are going to, you know, lose out in Syria, lose Lebanon. And yet their focus for so many years has been there to building up Hezbollah, making that a target, making Israel a target from Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, and using Syria as this transit point in which to put troops in. And they've fought a war there for now 8 years inside Syria to preserve Assad's rule. And yet the Bible says they're going to lose that territory. And so, you know, how would this prophecy come about unless Iran did experience some type of struggle, internal struggle? Maybe it has to focus on preserving its regime for a while. Maybe it does have to focus on bringing some of its forces back to Iran. We know that biblical prophecy indicates that they're going to recalibrate their forces towards the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea area, the Horn of Africa, North Africa, Egypt. And so we are in this period right now where they're not there, really. They're not really in Egypt. Mm. You know, they've got ties with the Muslim Brotherhood, but it's not a focus of theirs. And yet biblical prophecy says that they're going to have a different strategy than the one that they're employing right now. They're focused mainly on Syria and Lebanon. They're going to lose out on that. Maybe this temporary contraction of this king of the south that's led by Iran is going to lead to retreat from those areas for necessity's sake, to preserve the survival of the regime because of these horrible things to the regime happening. And then once it is preserved, it can push forward with another biblically prophesied strategy.
Well, we did mention just how different the individual who's replacing Qasem Soleimani is, that his focus is very much in North Africa. Maybe you could talk a little bit about just following up on that discussion from a few weeks back. And also, we were talking last week, of course, about this parliamentary election and how this could harden an already hardline government because of just how strict they were in deciding who the candidates were going to be, that it seemed to reflect an even tougher stance that the regime was taking. Maybe you could just catch us up to speed on what you think, having seen what happened with those elections.
Right. So Ismail Kani, he's the new leader of the Quds Force, and he historically has had more efforts focusing on Africa, focusing on fundraising efforts in Africa, focusing on exporting the Shiite way to Africa, focusing on funding different terrorist groups in Africa. And so Qasem Soleimani, while he was over it all, he was more focused on the Syrian battlefield. And so it's obviously they're losing a leader in Syria, and Carney isn't as focused on that and doesn't have that expertise. And already we are seeing some changes, especially with how the Iran uses the Houthis. They are becoming more and more Iran's weapon of choice. Hezbollah leadership is often down in Yemen, working with the Houthis, instructing them how to use the drones, instructing them how to use these ballistic missiles. Just this past week, they fired ballistic missiles against the G20 summit in Saudi Arabia. They were blown out of the sky before they got there by a Patriot battery from the United States. But this is some serious weaponry that Iran has at its disposal in this biblically prophesied zone of the Red Sea area that the Bible says they're going to control. And so we are already kind of seeing a bit of a shift in that way. And in terms of the election that just happened, I think there were 1,400 or 1,200 candidates, and half of them were cut out completely. Mm-hmm. And so only those that were, they say, conservative is what they say. But basically, they're hardliners. And when we say hardliner, we are talking about people that are more akin to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad rather than Rouhani. Rouhani still believes in the Islamic Revolution, the current president, but he believes the way there is to do business with the West and then subvert the West practices and then bring on the military, where you have the hardliners that are just like, let's get the money and let's go fight. And so we have more of those people in power right now inside Iran. And so while it might look like Iran itself as a nation is unable really, let's say, to make a push on the global scene because of all these other issues, internal issues it's got to deal with, the actual command structure from the Ayatollah down to the parliament, the Guardian Council that's there before the parliament, down to the commanders, this is becoming stronger. There's more pro Islamic Revolution people in the positions of power that increasingly hold the purse as well of the economy. That is just, you know, this group is getting more tight-knit and more strong. And so really, I think getting rid of the fat there, that what might have had a different way to achieve the Islamic Revolution's goals is going to preserve, let's say, the red meat of the Islamic Revolution's offensive force, if I can put it that way, which is what the biblical prophecy is all about. It's about a forward moving, offensive, pushy foreign policy of Iran that actually pushes with violence rather than soft power like we see partly under Rouhani.
You know, it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about Iran increasing its belligerence. It was attacking oil tankers. It was pushing in ways that we hadn't seen for quite some time, becoming more aggressive. It'll be interesting to watch what happens here as it's suffering from these curses that you're talking about, that it's being isolated by its neighbors and suffering these setbacks. Leaders of nations have their ideas about the way that they want things to go, but the fact is that they're subject to these larger forces that are outside of their control. And we do see God's hand shaping events in ways that are outside the designs of individuals and leaders of nations. You mentioned earlier on about just this resurgence that's taking place in the United States. I think there are a lot of people, as Stephen Fleury has been talking about on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, who are looking at this as, you know, the more golden years for the United States, that we're great again and we're going to keep on going from strength to strength. But the fact is, even the coronavirus, what we talked about initially, could impact the United States economy in ways that we can't foresee. It's just very difficult to tell how some of these things are going to play out, which is what makes the prophecies of the Bible that much more important for us to fix our eyes on. You know, Stephen Fleury was talking about several prophecies that talk about sudden destruction, and the people who are looking at America's resurgence as being something to really celebrate. I'm sure they're looking at Iran's setbacks as being, you know, in a very similar light, that maybe this does mean the end of the regime. But when you look at it in light of Bible prophecy, you see that that's a false hope, and that it's just going to make, when these do explode, that much more shocking to so many of the people who are watching this take place. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about this series of unfortunate events, if you want to call it that, that Iran has been experiencing this past year. He's written an article for thetrumpet.com about this. Corona caps Iran's catastrophic start to the year. You can watch for that. It should be up on the website soon if it's not there already. Thank you very much, Brent. Fascinating conversation. We appreciate it.
No worries.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Germany is experiencing a real leadership vacuum. It's uncertain who Chancellor Angela Merkel's successor will be. We're going to look at one individual who looks like a possible candidate for the next chancellor of Germany, Friedrich Merz. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Josue Michels. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Eka.
So, tell us about Friedrich Merz. He's been around for quite a long time. He's got quite a storied political history.
Yes, Friedrich Merz is a very interesting individual because we haven't heard from him on the political scene for many, many years. And then he had made a sudden comeback in 2018, essentially on the request of former finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble. And then he was running against Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer for the CDU party leadership. And that was just after Chancellor Angela Merkel announced that she would resign from the party leadership. So he came back into politics in a very sudden way, and he almost made it to the very top of the party leadership. So that was very interesting at the time to watch, because he's very opposed to Chancellor Merkel's policies. But now he had more than a year to prepare, and the party got more familiar with him again. Now he has even greater chances to come at the very top of the party.
So he was actually considered a top candidate for the chancellor quite a few years back. What happened to him at that time, and why is he being considered again now?
That's right. Back in the early 2000s, he was seen as a strong rival to Chancellor Angela Merkel, but at the time his policies didn't catch a fire, so to say, in the party. He was strong on making a tax reform, but the party at the time didn't really see the need for that, and he was also far stronger on resurrecting German pride and having a guiding culture, and also those topics weren't really an issue at the time in the early 2000s, and the liberal wing of the party was stronger at the time, and they saw themselves more represented in Chancellor Merkel. She was able to run for the next election, and she won, which meant that Friedrich Merz didn't see any future for himself in the party.
So it seems some of these elements that he is known for, the political climate has changed such that some of those things actually look a lot more attractive than they did 15, 20 years ago. People are in the climate of the alternative for Deutschland and some of these further right policies that have quite a lot of public support. Merz actually looks like he fits the bill closer to what people want today.
Yes, that's very, very interesting to watch right now, because he has been out of politics for 10 years. At the time he was in politics, his policies weren't really interesting to people, but since then we had an economic crisis in 2008 and 2009, and we also had a refugee crisis in 2015, and that changed the mood in Germany, and it looks like Friedrich Merz was ahead of his time with his policies. The guiding culture that basically says, well, if people come into our country, they have to adopt our culture. They have to live the way we live. Otherwise, they can't live here. That wasn't really an issue in 24, 25 when he raised that topic. But today, everyone is talking about it because we had 1 million refugees storming into the country. And now in the era of President Trump and trade wars, businesses are facing great threat, and Friedrich Merz stands out here because he really favors small businesses and he's really concerned about their success. He worked outside of politics as a corporate lawyer who essentially helps businesses to face those challenges. So he looks like a man that was prepared for helping Germany in the crisis they are now in.
One man that we have talked a lot about, Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg, he actually endorses Merz. He said that he wouldn't vote for anyone else. Why do you suppose he's so impressed?
Yes, that's interesting. Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg basically said, well, as from a voter's perspective, I would favor Friedrich Merz. But we know that he has much more influence in Germany than just the voters. So his words really count here. And he is very connected, in a sense, to Friedrich Merz because they have many shared similarities. Both of them have spent years outside of politics and have helped businesses. They also, their political career was marked by the transatlantic relationship. They have worked together with many American politicians and businesses. So they have a shared interest in that relationship. And they're also more conservative. And they also share the same Roman Catholic faith. So just from the perspective of what they are standing for, you can see why Guttenberg is much more in favor of Friedrich Merz. And they also had a common history with Chancellor Angela Merkel. They both, during their times in politics, faced Chancellor Angela Merkel and basically had to leave politics after not being able to stand against her.
Mm-hmm. There is a desire among the German people for a candidate who will stand up and who will be able to solve the immigration crisis, who has a certain pride in German culture, in German history. But at the same time, because of recent history, there's a fear that it would tip over into like pro-Nazism. You see a certain amount of that within the AfD, which is why so many politicians are so concerned about forming any kind of an alliance with the AfD. They need somebody who can stand up for those things without those negative associations. Does Friedrich Merz fit that bill?
Yes, he definitely does. It is interesting how many people are currently voting for the Far Right Party after all we have seen in Germany's history, and how much the media tries to portray the AfD party as a crazy far-right Nazi parties. We still have many millions of people who are willing to vote for the far-right. So that reflects just the thinking in Germany that you can say that more than even those people are desiring a stronger leader that is strong against immigration, that is strong on basically resurrecting Germany's strength and pride in the country. They want to see Germany succeed. They want to see Germany again gaining acceptance in the world and not being held back by their past. Mm-hmm. That's what the AfD represents. But the AfD, as you said, many see it as a continuation of the Nazi party that just got resurrected in recent years.
So this is a man who could reclaim some of the support that has been flowing to the AfD and reclaim it for the CDU.
Yes, that's his main promise as he came back into politics. He said we can easily halve the votership of the AfD right now, and that's the strongest candidate that the party has for that right now.
Tell us about his religion.
You don't know, hear much about politicians in Germany as far as their religion goes, but it is widely known that Friedrich Merz is Roman Catholic, and the area he is from, there are quite a few Roman Catholics. That's the Bonn area in Germany, and he stands for that. And I have read quite a few articles that said he would never go into a coalition with the AfD because of that faith. And also, when he was a politician in the early 2000s, one of his main policies which he campaigned for was that guiding culture, and that is essentially showing that he wants German to live by their Christian faith more and stand for it. He also talked about the persecution of Christians in the Middle East. That shows that he's interested in helping Christians around the world that face persecution. And you also see it why he's opposed in having more immigrants coming in. That can also factor into his religious beliefs.
And how much does he favor, say, a stronger Europe? We've seen this discussion that Emmanuel Macron, the French president, has been leading to try to unify Europe militarily. What are his views on that?
Yes, he's definitely pro-Europe, pro-European Union, and he has spoken strongly about the European army. And that made headlines also in 2008 when Emmanuel Macron made those comments. So you can see how he could work very closely with Emmanuel Macron. He also speaks very favorably of Sebastian Kurz in Austria. So we can see already an alliance building between those leaders. And we see that they have common policies. And he knows that Germany relies on export. So he knows that Germany relies on the European Union, on trade relationships, so he's very much in favor of that.
So we get a good idea of just what the political climate is in Germany and what things might look like when you have a man like this who maybe was ignored, didn't have the success that he would have liked some years ago, but now seems to be at least being pushed more to the front and being considered a lot more seriously. Looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, how does this play into what we expect to happen in Germany?
Yes, so we don't know exactly where this will be leading, if he will be just here for a few months and then disappear again. But you'd certainly see how the climate in Germany is changing. They're more willing to accept a leader that's further to the right, a leader that's strong for Germany's businesses. And those are things that we are expecting. We are expecting leaders that stand up against Chancellor Merkel's immigration policy, that stand up against Islam, that kind of try to disguise what the far right is doing and speak not that strongly about it and support more of a revisionist history, you could say, that kind of wants to leave the past behind and has Germany move forward. So those are trends that we are expecting. And we are expecting leaders that are pro-European, pro-European Union, and he fits that bill. So you can see how he is changing, in a sense, the mindset of the people. So that already can show that it is leading in the direction of Bible prophecy. Could he be a leader that leads Germany more in the direction? Bible prophecy also indicates that that could be the case. Trump editor and chief Gerald Fluey made a comment that we could have 10 kings plus an overarching king. That's a prophecy in Revelation 17 that indicates that. So we're expecting 10 leaders to rise in Europe that have one mind. And Friedrich Merz, he seems very similar to Emmanuel Macron and Sebastian Kurz, for example. And he is endorsed by Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. And we have often pointed out that Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg could be the leader that is leading all those 10 kings. So considering that factors, we could see that Friedrich Merz will play a much more active role in politics and perhaps even lead Germany as its next chancellor.
Well, very interesting. We've been talking to trumpet writer Josue Michels about Friedrich Merz, a man who seems to be building a good resume to become Germany's next chancellor. Certainly the fact that he's rising in the possibility of fulfilling that role tells you quite a lot about German politics today. Josue has written an article about this subject on thetrumpet.com. It's called, Is Friedrich Merz Germany's Future? Go check that out. And also, we have a trend article, The Rise of a German Strongman, Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of a German Strongman. You can find that under the trends section on our website. Thank you very much, Josue.
Thanks for having me again.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Australia has been burning from record-breaking wildfires earlier this summer. Now it's suddenly experiencing curses of an altogether different sort, as we will now hear in this report from Ariana Eames.
After suffering months of devastating fires across its east coast, Australia is now reeling under severe storms and flooding. The fires, which began in September, have burned over 27 million acres, an area larger than the size of Ireland. It has taken 33 lives, destroyed 3,000 homes, and killed an estimated 1 billion animals. But suddenly, and almost without warning, the situation changed. Many of the same parts of the country that suffered through devastating fires are now enduring flooding and record-setting rainfall. The fires began to subside and the next catastrophe set in during the first week of February. On the evening of February 5th, Byron Bay in New South Wales experienced its heaviest rainfall in 40 years. The same weather system hit much of the east coast of New South Wales. The rain submerged cars and caused knee-deep flooding in the area. While the rain was a welcome reprieve for firefighters, heavy rain on the fire-scorched earth could drain into local reservoirs and contaminate drinking water. This happened in Sydney's main water supply, where ash and debris forced authorities to switch to an alternate water source for the city. Despite the flooding, the rain is not enough for the drought-stricken country. Without more rain, parts of Australia still run the risk of taps running dry within the next 12 months. The country must focus on conserving water now, before the next dry spell comes. The rain also left over 100,000 people without water and inflicted several severe injuries. 4 people were hospitalized when a tree fell on their car, and a 16-year-old boy is believed to have sustained broken ribs after being trapped in debris in waist-deep water for 2 hours. To put the amount of rain the country has received into perspective, think on how much several reservoirs have been replenished. Warragamba Dam in New South Wales went from 0.9% to 43.8% full in 1 week. Many other dams saw similar or larger increases. One of Sydney's main dams saw an 18% increase in 2 days. And the February storms are continuing, causing devastation and loss of life. A Sydney man was killed when a giant wave during a severe storm on February 16th swept him and a woman into the ocean. A violent thunderstorm in Sydney on the night of February 18th took another man's life after he was hit in the head by a flying gas bottle. Sydney residents compared the storm to a tornado, which came and went within 40 minutes. Australia's Bureau of Meteorology is watching other weather systems that are expected to turn into tropical cyclones and ravage its coastline. While the rain has been beneficial for extinguishing fires and restocking empty water tanks, it is an example of the pendulum swing in weather that many have chalked up to climate change. What has been called Australia's Summer of Dread has even been dubbed Ground Zero for the climate crisis. In its interactive webpage titled Counting the Cost of Australia's Summer of Dread, The Guardian begins, "The world has never seen anything like it. Over 5 months, bushfires have changed how many Australians think about the climate crisis. What was, for many, an abstract idea set in a distant future has, in the space of one summer, begun to feel like a dystopian everyday reality. As leading researchers have observed, Australia is now ground zero and an unfolding catastrophe." Other sources are also issuing dire predictions. On February 15th, the New York Times published an article titled "The End of Australia as We Know It." There it wrote, "What many of us have witnessed this fire season does feel alive, like a monstrous gathering force threatening to devour what we hold most dear on a continent that will grow only hotter, drier, and more flammable as global temperatures rise." While there is almost unanimous agreement that fires and floods are tragic and only growing worse, not everyone adheres to this climate change propaganda. Several individuals have warned that this fire season's devastation was inevitable and not because of climate change. Australia has not taken the action needed to eliminate the accumulation of bush and undergrowth referred to as fuel load. The controlled burns that the Australian government once did regularly are happening less and less often. This alone begins to undermine the climate change argument. An article by Breitbart places the blame of Australia's fires primarily on environmentalists. Breitbart wrote, "So, to be clear, there is zero evidence of any climate change conditions that might have increased the likelihood or severity of these bushfires. This is not, repeat, not a man-made climate change story, and anyone who claims otherwise is either a gullible idiot or a lying charlatan. The people most to blame for the Australian bushfires are the Greens. Just like in California, the tree-hugging gaia worship blinded them to the reality that forests need regular clearance and maintenance if they are not to become a major fire hazard. But the second thing that climate change activists leave out, and that is also left out by those who blame Australia's green policies, is God's hand in these events. In 2009, trumpet writer Ron Fraser wrote about a similar situation in Australia in his article titled Australia: Fires, Floods, and Fulfilled Prophecy. In his article, he pointed to a prophecy in Amos 4. Here God tells the nations of Israel that because they will not turn to him, he says, "I have withholden the rain from you when there were yet 3 months to the harvest, and I caused it to rain upon one city and caused it not to rain upon another city. One piece was rained upon, and the piece whereupon it rained not withered. So two or three cities wandered into one city to drink water, but they were not satisfied. Yet have ye not returned to me, says the Eternal." Here, in verses 7 through 8, God says that he causes it to rain in some places and to cease raining in others. God is cursing our nations with flooding and drought because we have not turned to him. In 1996, trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote, "When we continue to have serious floods and droughts at the same time, it is a warning from God. And this is only the beginning." Mr. Fraser also wrote, "If ever there was a land whose people largely cannot bear all the words of the prophecies of God for these times, it surely has to be the hedonistic, increasingly homophile, largely godless people of my beloved home country, Australia. Like the rest of the world, Australians have refused to submit to the laws of God. They will do anything they can to continue sinning and deflect the blame for these disasters onto climate change. But until they turn to God in repentance, these disasters will only continue to worsen. To understand why suffering is occurring across the world, read our free booklet, Why Natural Disasters."
It's time for today's last word.
In our world today, people are taking offense at a lot of things. They're allowing themselves to be ruled by negative emotions. Last week in this time, I talked about just how important emotions are and how we need to control them and to use them to our advantage rather than letting them control us. Well, I want to give you a bit of Bible-based advice on how to avoid being offended, how to overcome offense, and how to govern your emotions in this way. Probably the best single verse about this is Psalm 119, verse 165. It says, "Great peace have they which love thy law, and nothing shall offend them." This is fantastic advice. This is how to avoid being caught in the trap of being offended. It says, love God's law. Follow that outflowing law of love. Now, what does God's love look like? You can see the answer to that question in 1 Corinthians 13. It says, love is very patient. It's very kind. Love knows no jealousy. Love makes no parade. It gives itself no airs. It's never rude, never selfish, never irritated. That's the way the Moffat translation reads in that passage. Now, if you contrast the love that's being described in that passage with self-love, you can see just how much the opposite they really are. Self-love can be very impatient. It's very easily provoked. It can be very rude. It can be selfish. God's love is none of those things. Obeying that law of love helps you to remain calm and stable and unoffended. Submitting to God means always loving the other person. And it also helps to make you more compassionate. You have a clearer perspective on your own faults, and then that helps you to recognize your own contributions to interpersonal conflicts. It makes you a lot less judgmental toward others' struggles. Matthew 5, verses 38 through 44 give this advice. Resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue you at the law and take away your coat, let him have your cloak also. You've heard that it has been said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. And incidentally, that's not from God's law. That was just something that people were saying, and it's very contrary to God's law in the Old Testament. Christ said, I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, and do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Now, is it difficult to do that? Of course it is. It's absolutely opposite the spirit of this world and the things that we naturally tend to do in response to provocation. But the power to choose your own reaction is completely under your control. If you have that take no offense attitude, then if you get a nasty email or a cold look or a criticism, that's not going to hurt you. If people come after you, that's not going to provoke you. You're going to be bulletproof to that kind of an attack, because your strength doesn't come from self-righteousness, which is very vulnerable and very susceptible to being provoked. It comes from God and his law of love. Jesus Christ was mocked. He was ridiculed and beaten, tortured, crucified. But how did he respond? He prayed, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That's the absolute opposite of the hypersensitive, vindictive attitude that this world is deliberately cultivating in people, that you see on college campuses, you see in politics, and you see more and more in society today, that is absolutely ripping our society apart. How do you respond to slights and insults? Do you think like Jesus Christ, or do you think like the devil? How much have you mastered your emotions? Are you easily offended? Are you prone to emotional outbursts over small issues? Are your emotions immature and harmful? Are they founded on reality, or are they based on assumptions and misperceptions and lies? We all need to monitor and to regulate our responses to what happens in our lives. We have to develop real awareness of our own emotions and become attuned to what's going on in our own mind in order to identify what's causing our emotion and to recognize when we're getting emotional in a destructive way. More rock-solid advice can be found in Proverbs 14:29. It says, he that is slow to wrath is of great understanding, but he that is hasty of spirit or quick-tempered exalts folly. Mastering your emotions it's not just about being slow to wrath, it's also about cultivating and using right emotion. You can read in Philippians 4 where it says, finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. This is something to go after and to set your mind on that will really go a long way to helping you to control your emotions and to set them on a right course. In stark contrast to self-love, God's love is never glad when others go wrong. Love is gladdened by goodness, always slow to expose, always eager to believe the best, always hopeful, always patient. That's what 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7 says. That's a fantastic description of how we need to respond to slights and offenses and problems and conflicts. That's the kind of emotional mastery that we really need to work to develop. That is true emotional maturity. And somebody with godly emotional maturity is able to not only avoid the drastic extremes of emotion that we see in society today, but he can also build a powerful and vivid, meaningful life, growing closer to the creator of emotion. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on the program today to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal, Josue Michels, and Ariana Eames. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Theodore Roosevelt. When you play, play hard. When you work, don't play at all. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time. Keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.